Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Wear, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I am so excited to speak with Sabina Latta, the founder of a brand I have come to love over the past few months, Dough. Just last year, Sabina started the Better For You cookie dough brand with flavors like Immune Support Chocolate Chip, Collagen Support Brownie Batter, and Stress Relief Ginger Doodle. In addition to the fact that it contains impactful ingredients like adaptogens and vitamins, dough also stands out for everything it doesn't have in it. Each product is vegan, gluten-free, and trust me when I say this, seriously delicious. I am not vegan, I am not gluten-free, and I love this stuff. You can either bake it or eat it straight from the jar. Either way, it's reintroducing health-conscious consumers to a category they're eager to participate in once again, leading to astonishing growth for the company. Already, the brand is in LA-based health food mecca Erewhon, and my feeling is it won't be long until the nationwide retailers follow suit. But if you can't wait, and I certainly couldn't blame you, Dough is also available via their own e-commerce website with nationwide shipping. But back before Sabina embarked on a seriously sweet venture of her own, she actually ran a venture studio at M13 where she helped launch a number of companies and learned the playbook to build a successful CPG brand. Before that, she was a business consultant at McKinsey, and even earlier in her career, she worked at major food conglomerates, Diamond Foods, and PepsiCo. As you can imagine, those experiences led to a deep understanding of the world of consumer packaged goods and, eventually, an understanding of how she would disrupt it. I can't wait for you to hear her entire journey. Now, on Second Life, it's Sabina Latta. Okay, so Sabina, we like to take things all the way back to the beginning on this podcast. So what did you study in school? And more importantly, what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
So I studied supply chain management, which is probably like the world's most boring major. Well, I wanted to study fashion, mm-hmm. which is funny that I'm chatting with you. And then I wanted to study social work, but my parents are immigrants. So both of those majors were, I wouldn't say unacceptable, but they were a little frowned upon because they came here with nothing. And they were like, you know, you should probably be like a doctor or an engineer. So I'm obviously an entrepreneur now, but mm-hmm. I think when you are an immigrant and you come to the States, especially in their time, entrepreneurship wasn't this sexy thing, right? It wasn't cool to be like a founder. It was like
being a founder got a glow up recently.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. When you're an immigrant, you're just doing it to like make ends meet. It's more of like, oh, you didn't necessarily have like the right education or an American education. And right. So entrepreneurship was not as glorified for them.
That is such an excellent point. I'm so glad that you pointed that out because that's not something that has come up before. And now that you're saying it, it's just like light bulb moment. Of course, that makes sense.
Yeah. And I figured out I was entrepreneurial over my career, but I didn't know that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. But even if I had said that, I think my parents would have been like, maybe we do something else.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. So what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
So it's funny, I majored in supply chain to kind of back channel into fashion because I had heard buyers, right, uh-huh. of the big box retailers had to have a, you know, super sound understanding of procurement, supply chain operations. And so that was the original plan. And, you know, I ended up in food and beverage, probably a little bit of kind of influence from what my dad did. But that was the original plan when you're just forced to kind of choose one, you know, your freshman year and you're like, I guess I'll choose this.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. So I am a big fan of those early jobs. And I think that everything that we learn in those early jobs, whether it's like before our career job or it's our first job out of school, really impact us. And we learn all these things that we don't even realize that we're learning. So I'm wondering if you can tell me about your first job and mm-hmm. any formative skills that you learned or ways in which it shaped you.
Yeah. So I've had a job since I was 15 years old, even a little bit earlier, probably because I would like tutor my cousins and somehow yes. get paid for it. But I was one of those people that always had a job all throughout college. Like I've just always working was just like a part of life. Mm-hmm. So my first job was at a call center. And it's funny because I'm a Pisces. Well, mm-hmm. I'm a Pisces sun, but I'm a Leo moon and an Aries rising, which
oh, wow.
my sun is highly sensitive, right? But my other two signs are fire signs. Like at a call center, can you imagine? You get yelled at like all day long.
Yeah.
So I was so emotional in my first job because I would just like get yelled at and be like, I'm sorry, I don't know what to do. But I mean, the biggest learning was how to kind of get that thicker skin and not yeah. let, you know, negative energy or negative comments or, you know, when someone else is having a bad day, how to not let that affect you. Oof. But that was kind of one of the first times that I learned that lesson.
I mean, something I'm still working on to this day, but it's yeah. true. So out of school, you worked at PepsiCo, specifically at Frito-Lay. Can you tell me about getting that job, how you ended up applying for it, what you thought it was going to be like versus what it actually was like? Because I feel like that's always kind of an interesting situation.
Yeah. So my relationship with food or junk food, if you will, goes back to when I was a kid. So like I mentioned, my parents were immigrants. So my mom was a nurse and my dad was an entrepreneur, but kind of also worked odd jobs. Like he worked in a deli, he drove a taxi. And then the culmination of his career was when he was able to buy a gas station and a convenience store in kind of a suburb of Fort Worth in Texas. Mm-hmm. And so I used to spend every Saturday just in his gas station because they couldn't afford childcare. So my sisters and I would spend every weekend in his gas station and we would be like behind the counter counting change and eating all of the snacks. We always got to pick two snacks that we could eat in the gas station. I mean, it was like the glory years in the 90s, right? Of yes. like these big food brands like Pop-Tarts and Lunchables and, you know, Smucker's Uncrustables.
Yes. I
know. It's like everything we grew up on, but didn't know was bad for you.
Totally.
And Frito-Lay products obviously are one of the fastest turning, best selling products in a convenience store. So I grew up on Hot Cheetos and Oreos. So when it came time to get kind of my first internship junior year, that's when those big sexy brands were something that, you know, both my parents understood, I understood them, they're kind of tangible products, and they're just fun brands. So that's kind of what piqued my interest in applying for a job at Pepsi.
I mean, that is so amazing on so many levels and really sweet. That just pulls at my heart. So you grew up with these brands, but what was it like actually working for them?
Yeah. So I interned there. And then when I graduated, I took a full-time offer on the Lay's brand, which is the biggest chip brand in the world. So in the States, it does about $3 billion of revenue a year, which is wild. And at the time, I was 22, right out of college, mm-hmm. and I was teaching myself a lot about nutrition. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting. I got certified in Pilates. And then I had this blog before blogs were cool. It was called Skinny Lately. I thought it was so clever with the name of it. But I would write about like juice cleanses and I would write about cryotherapy and like all of these wellness trends I was learning about. And at the same time at work, my sales goal was to sell more pounds of potato chips per American than the previous year. Which Whoa. At the surface, it's a sales goal, right? Like they've got yeah. shareholders, like they've got to add value to the company. So at the surface is a sales goal. But at the core, there's kind of this almost like dissonance that yeah. happened where I'm like telling my friends and family to try a kale juice cleanse. And then at the same time at work, I'm, you know, selling more pounds of potato chips. So I would say there was like that kind of internal dialogue that I was mm-hmm. having. And then at the same time, like those companies, PepsiCo, P&G, those big consumer products companies are really good training grounds.
Yeah.
Like you learn what makes a brand. You learn how to go to market. You learn how to launch new products. I mean, you learn how to make a TV commercial. There are so many things that you learn at such a fast pace in those companies that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily get elsewhere. So I would credit a lot of just what I know today to Pepsi and to Frito-Lay, even though I was selling something that I wasn't necessarily connected to.
Right, which I guess is the hallmark of a good salesperson too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So what did that actually mean, like from a day-to-day basis? Like how do you go about getting people to buy more potato chips when you are fresh out of college?
Yeah, so it was funny because we at that time, so it was 2012, it's kind of what Gen Z is to companies today. It was when millennials were first going into the workforce.
Uh-huh.
And so millennials were just glorified. Now millennials are chuggy and made fun of. But like before, we were so cool in the workforce because we were educating, you know, the boomer VPs about all of these millennial trends. Even just like Snapchat, like explaining what Snapchat was at the time, or, you know, how video content was becoming more important, or how we should move our spend from, we were doing a ton of print and radio, and how we should move that to digital. And at the time it was Facebook, which was the big platform. But I remember launching this newsletter internally at the company at Frito-Lay, and it was called the Millennial Minute. And I would literally highlight like the top five millennial trends of the week.
This is what the kids are into.
This is what the kids, I know. And now I have my designer and social media manager telling me what the kids are into. I'm like, what are the TikTok trends? But that was me at one point in 2012.
Yep.
So that's where the real impact came, is like, I had a VP who's still a mentor of mine on Dough today, and he just realized like this generation is the future. So if we don't crack how to connect with them and sell product to them and just build a brand with them, then we will die with the older generation. And so he was just very in tune with that. And I kind of joke that he was my original entrepreneurial spark, because he kind of allowed me to do whatever the hell I wanted on digital. And one of those insights that, you know, the team found out, we had a whole insights team, was that millennials want flavor. That's a big product value for a lot of brands nowadays. Mm-hmm. But at the time, you know, Lay's had, you know, sour cream and onion, cheddar, like sea salt was like the most, like the best performing, the yellow bag Lay's. So we did an entire campaign around flavor, because that's what we were betting on that, you know, young people wanted. So we kind of doubled down. We called the program Do Us a Flavor. And we essentially had America submit flavors for a chance to win $1 million and that we would produce the flavors that the Americans came up with. So the three flavors I remember were chicken and waffles, which was so trending at the time. And it was, you know, highly millennial. It was sriracha, which I thought we were a little behind on, but it had blown up at the time. And then the third one was cheesy garlic bread, which was the most mainstream. That one ended up winning. But anyways, it was a combination of, you know, creating product that resonated with the young consumer, but then also, you know, moving our budget to not just, you know, radio, print, and the old school advertising, but it was moving it to kind of the digital formats and social media as well.
I love this. That's so interesting. So after that, you moved on to Diamond Foods as an associate brand manager. Why did you decide to do that? What does that job actually mean? Because it's always fascinating to me. It's so different than the world I know, and I'm so curious.
Yeah. So again, kind of going back to bosses and mentors that allowed me to be entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. I had one in particular, his name was Burke Rain, and he went to Diamond Foods. And he was essentially like, there's this associate brand manager role. And usually it requires an MBA. And at the time, you know, MBAs were important. Now, not at all, I would say, but it would require an MBA. But I will essentially let you like skip the MBA and you would get this role. And I was unsure. I mean, like I said, I had a supply chain management degree and I had a business undergrad. So I didn't know if I necessarily needed my MBA or wanted to pay $200,000 for it. Like, it's quite expensive. And I was unsure about it at the time. So I was like, I mean, if I can skip the line, like, let me skip the line. Mm-hmm. And I was in way over my head when I was in that role. But I would say, like, that's the fastest way to learn something, right? It's like when you have no idea what the hell you're doing. So moved to San Francisco, which, you know, I'd been in Texas my whole life. So I was like, oh my gosh, California is so cool. Like, yes, let me move to like one of the food meccas in the country, which, you know, a lot of food trends start on the West Coast. So that's how I got that job. And I, like I said, I was in way over my head, but it's a way to just learn really super fast.
So in doing research for this, I read that you were basically like a team of one on this business, which is a $250 million business, which just made my stomach drop. What did that feel like? You said you were in over your head.
Yeah.
What does that mean exactly? And how did you go about it?
Yeah. So the brand management role at big CPG companies is essentially like a general management role. There's the brand team that's kind of the hub, is how I explain it. And then the spokes of the wheel are finance, innovation, the ad agency, operations, supply chain. So you're the hub and the decision maker and the GM, and the other functions don't necessarily report to you, but they kind of report into you. So when I joined, there was another person who was very experienced on the brand team, and she left like a month in. And so I was like, oh, shit, oh, goodness. Just me. Like, let's see. I was 24 years old. I was like, how am I going to do this? I worked a lot. So now I'd say I'm a little more balanced, but I'm a strong believer of like when you're young and you have it in you, and you know this, you know, being in fashion, like you have to work your ass off. And like if you're learning and you're enjoying it, then take advantage of those opportunities. And so I would say like I worked all the time, but I was really stubborn. And I think one thing I could have learned in that role is to take more feedback. But I will say that that also, it's a double-edged sword, right? Because entrepreneurs and founders tend to be on the stubborn side because you have to be a little crazy and think your idea is going to work, right? And like, yeah, like F the haters. And so I would say that one thing that I would have done is been a little less stubborn and more in the learning mindset. But the way I managed was honestly a lot on my partners. And that was the first role where I truly learned what cross-functional management means.
Yeah.
Like often you have at these bigger companies like Google or Facebook or a lot of these bigger tech companies, you have such silos and you have, you know, like one person that works on email marketing that doesn't ever get exposure to the operation side of the business, right? Mm-hmm. Or like the product development side of the business. So being able to manage cross-functionally and honestly manage a ton of different personalities, like being able to build that bridge was so important. And so though it was hard to kind of grease the wheel and like get that going, I would say the biggest saving grace was my ability to learn that relationship management from my cross-functionals and just understanding what it means to kind of be a matrixed organization, if that makes sense.
Totally. And also, not to put words in your mouth, because this might not be your experience at all, but I also feel like when I was in my early 20s and feeling in over my head, that sometimes that would make me just as a function of youth, like bear down more about something because there's some part of me that just knew I was in over my head a little bit. And like, as a defense mechanism.
The defense mechanism,
To deal with it, that piece of it, it almost feels like if you're listening to someone else, it's a weakness or you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then you trace that all the way out and you're like, and then they're going to fire me, instead of realizing what a strength it is. And that's something I think comes with time and age and confidence, or at least it did in my case. All of this to say, I totally understand. So I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, it's not like people don't know, you know, how old you are and how much experience you have. Like, they all knew I was like a 24-year-old kid. And, you know, so there's something to prove almost. It's like, no, I'm going to prove to you that I can do this and that I'm capable.
Yep, totally. Okay, so tell me about your next big switch, because you went to McKinsey. We've had a number of people who have gone that route on the show. I find it so interesting. Consulting is so curious to me. I'm fascinated by it. I still don't think I fully understand it.
I don't think I fully understand
it. I don't know. It's like holding a handful of goo. Like, I think I have it all supported and figured out, and then like some of it slides off. So if you could tell me a little bit about why you decided to make that transition, what it was like, what you were looking for, I would love to know.
Yeah. I mean, by the end of my time at Diamond, I think I was a little burnt out. It's funny because I felt pigeonholed. So, you know, when you're at a big CPG company, especially food and beverage one, you kind of know your path. Like, you know, you'll get promoted to a brand manager and then a director and then a senior director. And then eventually you'll kind of ladder up to being the CMO. And that was the goal. And I kind of wanted to break away from that. And I felt almost like claustrophobic in my career where like, oh my gosh, I've been only in food and beverage. I've been in one industry. You know, I know my path and I know it will lead to a CMO. And I didn't necessarily want that. And a lot of my mentors took that path, but I didn't want that for me. So I wanted to get out of that space, which is so funny because now I'm back in it, full circle. But I wanted to get out of that space as like fast as humanly possible. And I was like, outside of going to business school, how do I like expand very quickly? And that's what consulting and those firms like McKinsey do for you, is they will give you exposure to any type of business you would want exposure to, because all of the big Fortune 500 companies have usually multiple consulting firms working on different projects at any point in time. So I worked on everything from like medical waste management to like luxury cars to media and entertainment, telco. I worked on a big telco company. So you can essentially diversify very quickly, and it's an easy way to do it in a 2-year span. And so I joke that I got my MBA at McKinsey, but the projects range anywhere from like 6 weeks to, you know, call it 12 weeks. And so you rapid fire learn an industry super fast. And then if you like it, you can stay in it. And if you don't, you can move on to the next project. Also, for someone with ADHD, it also helps the variety piece, because you get to learn, you know, a ton of different industries in a super fast pace.
I mean, talk about intimidating, imposter syndrome, all of those things, like to be so young and to go in and say like, hey, this is how you solve this problem, or I'm going to advise you on this. How did you deal with that?
Yeah, it's funny because that's why a lot of people hate consultants. It's usually like, you know, kids in their 20s or like recent MBA grads telling these people who have worked for 30, 40 years at the same company in the same function what to do. And I also would find that off-putting if I were on the other side. And so I think there's an IQ-EQ balance when you're in consulting. And a lot of consultants have very high IQ, but the best consultants have very high EQ. And just empathizing with the client and almost serving as like a partner, that's what makes the best consultants. So I found, I mean, back to relationship management, but I found that EQ piece being the unlock for me, at least during my time at McKinsey.
Got it. So what would you say are the biggest skills that you were developing while you were there, or biggest missteps, biggest learning moments?
Yeah, so I think the biggest skill is problem solving. Mm-hmm. I mean, McKinsey, Bain, BCG, all the big consulting firms will kind of emphasize that they teach you that, and they are 100% right. You have to think outside the box to solve some of these problems, depending on, you know, what you're working on. And doing it in an efficient, effective way is, it's a learned skill, right? Like, I still learn it every day, because all I do is fight fires every day doing what I do now. But I think creative problem solving is the number one skill I learned there. And then I would say the second is probably client services, or mm-hmm. or how to be in service to others. I'm a CEO of my own company now, but still, it's not often me telling people what to do. It's me asking, like, what do you need from me? Or like, what blockers do you have that I can help with? So almost like acting in service of partners or, you know, coworkers or employees or bosses or whatever it is. That was kind of the second big skill I learned there.
Okay, that makes sense. So at this point, you have spent about 2 years in each position. And when that 2-year mark rolled around again, you decided to make another pivot. And you joined the team at M13, which is an incubator and launch pad. Tell me a little bit about why that appealed to you, what you were doing there. Did it require any adjustments in the way that you were thinking or in strategy?
Yeah. So M13 is a venture capital firm. So they've got an investment arm, and then they've got a venture studio, which is where we launched brands from within. So the reason M13 was interesting is I had bosses and mentors who allowed me to be entrepreneurial throughout my career, including mm-hmm. at McKinsey. So the digital practice was really new at McKinsey. And so we were, you know, building that practice at McKinsey. And the main partner that I worked with, Arun, he was entrepreneurial himself. And so he allowed me to kind of run things as well. And so I'd always had this kind of thread of being almost like an intrapreneur at big companies.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, but like, you're not actually an entrepreneur because you have a huge safety net because you're at a huge company. So I had wanted to explore that side of me, and I didn't know how. So I had, like everyone does, had concepts of like what business I would launch, or, you know, I had a running list of ideas of things I wanted to test. But you don't know how to test them until you actually do it. And so that's why M13 was so appealing, because, you know, they invested in early stage, so seed, series A. I think now they invest a little bit later. And then the launch pad was essentially my opportunity to learn how to launch a company from zero to one, and then create a playbook to do that over and over again, because that's what we wanted to do internally. We wanted to launch brands over and over again. So when I joined, the first brand that we launched was a women's nutrition brand. It's now called Rae, R-A-E. It's a supplement company. And at the time, we were testing six brands. So essentially what we were able to do there is we concepted different growth terrains where we were like, okay, there's, you know, interest in supplements, there's interest in low FODMAP diets, there's interest in, you know, skin conditions. And so we would kind of look at broad trends, and then we would dwindle them down to brands and concepts. And then we would go live with them and put them on pre-order. So we would create fake websites and fake packaging. And we would essentially be working on the back end to make sure that we could actually create what we were testing. And we wanted to see how many people would come through and place an order on the website. So that was our way to gauge interest. So we looked at a ton of different, I mean, we looked at like conversion rates, we looked at how many email addresses we got. There were a ton of different metrics that we looked at, but that was essentially a way to de-risk launching a brand. And at the time, you know, Facebook ads were cheaper. Now Facebook ads are, you know, but at the time Facebook ads were cheaper. So you can kind of throw up ads and see what people are reacting to and see if people actually wanted the product. The reason we did that is because I don't know if you've ever done focus groups.
Yep.
The great thing about focus groups is people will talk to you qualitatively about, you know, their thoughts or what they do. But a lot of people also lie in focus groups.
Yeah.
So, you know, I did one with coffee, for example, and it was so funny. This was a while back, but we're asking folks, you know, how do you take your coffee? And consumers were like, oh, I like it black. And then we bring in a ton of, you know, creamers and milks, and almost all of the consumers added in some sort of milk or creamer. And so it's just funny, like what people say versus what they actually do.
Yep.
So the reason we did this and like actually put up fake websites is because we wanted to see if people were actually betting with their wallet versus just saying like, oh, yeah, I would love, you know, that type of supplement.
Well, it's that idea of like, that's like the aspirational version of their behavior that they would like to publicly proclaim, but doesn't always match up to what we actually do.
Yes.
At
yeah,
all.
Exactly. I mean, I'm guilty of it too. So anyways, that's all to say, like, I essentially was able to learn how to, you know, launch a business and how to test it before, you know, putting my own money into it and raising a ton of money from investors. And I was able to learn that at M13. And I'm so grateful for that opportunity because it taught me how to go from zero to one, because it's a different world.
Yeah, totally. That makes sense. So tell me about some of the biggest mistakes that you would see made in the, sort of those early moments, whether it's startup teams or founders. Where do people have the hardest time?
So a couple of the insights that we learned were, the founding team is not necessarily the team that's going to be there at the Series A or the Series B or when the company exits or goes public.
Yep.
And I think when the founder was really self-aware about it is when the company was the most successful. So like, I mean, I even know now, I'm not the right person to run this brand when it's, you know, $50 or $100 million. Like, I'm great at the early stage and I'm great at the brand building and the growing early on. But once it gets too processy and red tape-y and like legal has to approve your social media posts, like,
yep,
that's when I know like, all right, I'm out, right? And so like I learned that there from founders who were like, okay, you know, I took this from call it zero to Series B or Series C, and now I need to bring on a new CEO or a president. And so, you know, kind of having that recognition that the team that starts isn't necessarily the team that ends was a really big learning for me at the time. And then I would say that marrying the quantitative and the qualitative, I think I got like obsessed with the quantitative of like, you know, if we hit these conversion rates, then the brand is set to launch and like we'll do well. But there's almost this like qualitative magic that you feel about a brand or the community that you can't quite put your finger on, but you know when it's there. And that aspect of it, I would say, it's almost like a gut, right? It's like if you have a good gut about a consumer product or even in your case, like a consumer media company. So I think refining my gut and almost like my intuition was a big learning too.
I mean, so important. And I think that's one too that takes a minute for everyone. I know certainly for myself as a woman, I would sort of ignore a lot of that early on, like the gut, I didn't think that really meant anything. And now I realize it's like a superpower. So please pay attention to it.
And not everyone knows like the consumer as well as you do. You know, I've got a woman named Cameron who she just graduated college and she's been working with me from the beginning. And she does a lot of our, you know, graphic design and a lot of our social media. And she's so in touch with the consumer that I often tell her, I'm like, you might know the consumer more than I do. So tell me what you're feeling. Like, tell me if you think something is not right or is not working or if we should double down on something. It can be really magical for a brand, especially a consumer brand.
So you spent about a year and a half and then you left. Tell me about that decision. Do you always have a plan like long in advance before you make the move? Is it more spontaneous? And what did you do next?
Yeah. So I usually have a plan, but in this case, I didn't. It's like before I've left every job, I've had, you know, the other job lined up and I usually give like a generous 4 weeks notice. So no one hates me when I'm leaving.
Yeah.
But this one, I didn't. This one, I just had this feeling that I needed to go off on my own and explore that. And I kind of also had this feeling that I had gotten all of the experiences that I needed to feel comfortable to make that move. Mm-hmm. I had gotten like the big company experience. I had gotten the consulting, like problem solving experience. I had gotten the startup experience, which was kind of like the X factor. So I had kind of had this like, okay, my career's coming to a place where I think I should be doing something. I just don't know what it is. Or, I mean, maybe it was also like a quarter life crisis. I don't know. But like a lot of my friends went through the same thing, like around like late 20s, early
30s. Saturn return.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. It's your Saturn return. It's like at 27. People sort of have a moment of upheaval and they're trying to figure out something new or what it's going to be.
That's wild. Yeah, that's exactly what happened. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew how to make money. I think coming from kind of like a lower socioeconomic background and, you know, again, immigrant parents, you have this kind of fear of like not having cash for some whatever reason, right? Like you're like, I can't be poor because like my parents came to this country and like gave up everything they had to make sure I got an education and like my dumb ass is not going to like go be broke and, you know, have to take money from my parents.
Right.
So there's almost this like Darwinism that happens of like, I will survive. And that's why I started consulting. So I started working with startups based on, you know, everything that I learned at M13. And I would say a lot of, you know, my background in consumer products was valuable to founders. And so I didn't know what I was going to do, but it was almost this bridge of like, well, I can support myself and pay my rent with consulting while I will still be able to have a little bit of space and almost that like creative space you need where if you're working 60 hours a week, it's really hard to, you know, delve into an idea or like blow out a concept because you don't have the space in your brain. So that's honestly why I did that is to be able to explore concepts and then as well give myself like the creative space. I don't know how people do it where they're like, oh, I have a full-time job and then I, you know, started this thing on the side and I work like 100 hours. Like, I don't know how people do that. I like need the creative space.
Absolutely. I understand that completely. So at what point did you start thinking about starting your own thing? And I'm so curious about how that ideation process worked for you early days.
There were a couple of different concepts. There was one that I still love it. It was called Playhouse. Mm-hmm. And it was a social house concept that was right before the pandemic. And we threw a couple of events in LA to just see how it would work and see if it would add value to people. And I mean, thank God I didn't go fundraise for that.
Yeah.
Like, because it was literally right before the pandemic. So that would have been wild. But Dough came to me when I was taking a ton of supplements. So I would say call it like May, June of the pandemic. I was taking like elderberry and vitamin D and zinc and basically everything to kind of just, you know, insure me. I didn't know if it was working, but I was like, I want to insure myself from this and just boost my immune system. And, you know, my husband works at Erewhon, if you're familiar with Erewhon.
Very.
And, you know, he would just bring me every sort of immunity vitamin or shot or juice that they were selling. So I was essentially like amping up my immune system, but I was up to like 10 pills a day.
Wow.
It was wild. And it would get stuck in my throat and I would get heartburn and I would get a stomach ache. And it just like was not a pleasant experience.
Yeah.
And so the concept originally was, do you know Famous Amos cookies?
Of
like
course.
Those old school little mini cookies. I was like, what if we could just have all of these immunity supplements in these tiny little baked cookies, and I could take that bite as my vitamins versus taking all these vitamins because it's not working for me. The concept kind of evolved after I had some of my friends pull some data for me. They're in private equity, and I was like, can you pull data on the cookie category? And I was like, okay, holy crap, I can't enter. It's like so saturated. There's like a million brands. They're all doing like grain-free, gluten-free, like every version of free, like allergen-free. I was like, okay, people have already come up with this. Like, I don't want to touch that. So then the cookie dough concept kind of came up because I was like, who's in the cookie dough space? It's like Pillsbury, Nestle Toll House. There's like a couple of other brands here and there, but I hadn't eaten cookie dough in, you know, 10 years, right? Like our consumer hasn't touched that product in 10, 15 years. We've moved on to other sexier snacks like, you know, ice cream has a lot of innovation, or even like on like chocolate, like Hue chocolate or like Honey Mamas. Like there's a ton of other brands that we had moved on to. So we decided to test the concept on Instagram, and we would do these drops, these limited quantity drops of cookie dough, which is so funny when I say it out loud, but we would be like, DM us to place an order and then just Venmo us $20 and we'll ship you some cookie dough. So it was like super scrappy and we just wanted to see, you know, what the reception would be. And we started selling out in like 30 minutes. So we would, you know, drop at 10 a.m. on a Monday.
Which, by the way, would not strike me as like peak cookie buying time. So this is even more amazing.
Maybe during COVID, a lot more people were on their phone. But it's there's also this like hype beast. We didn't intend to do that. But like when there's a limited quantity of something, all of a sudden everybody wants it. Like,
yeah. And it's a novel way of delivering and like going through the process. Like I buy sandwiches from Carla's Cafe in this way where it's like you have to DM for the order and then Venmo and then you go and pick it up. Like it's a whole thing. You know, it's ceremonial and it's excellent.
Yeah. Well, it's like the opposite of like making the user experience easy. Like let's make it as hard as possible.
So tell me about the recipe process first. Like, how did you come up with the recipe? Like, what do you know about cookie dough, young lady?
Well, so I am not good in the kitchen. I literally just like chop my onions and like my husband cooks and I'm his sous chef and he'll just like bark at me like, can you hand me this? Like, okay, yeah, because I like, I'm just not good in the kitchen. But I had a friend at the time who plant-based baked a lot and she made like excellent plant-based desserts. I'm not vegan or plant-based. I try to eat more plants than not. But the reason we went plant-based and gluten-free is more about the accessibility. And then if you make it vegan, you can also eat it raw.
Yes.
There's no eggs. And then you can heat treat the oat flour so that you can just eat it right out of the jar. If I just want like a release, I will have reality TV on. I'll have a glass of wine and just like it is the most therapeutic thing to do. And so that was the original. I was like, okay, we have to be able to have it eaten raw. I also want people to be able to bake it if we can. And then I want it to be accessible. And so that was kind of like the brief that I gave her. And we looked at a bunch of different ingredients and she would literally like make a bunch of samples like A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and then in like different little jars and like drop them to my house. And then I would like taste them and give her feedback on which one I liked or like which ones I wanted to mash up. We went through the whole alphabet. And then I think we got halfway through like the second, like A, 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 B, A, C, like halfway through the second alphabet. And then finally landed on, it was just chocolate chip that we were doing. So we were like, this is it. And then to confirm it, we dropped a bunch of samples off to our friends and family in LA. And it was kind of fun because everyone was at home and they didn't have anything better to do. And so they kind of like looked forward to it. And then we gave them this like 5-minute survey to fill out afterwards. So that was another way that we were able to just like quickly get feedback on the recipe and make sure it wasn't just, because it's hard, taste buds are hard, you know?
Yeah.
Like you might like something, but like, who knows if the rest of the country will like it. So we wanted to make it as approachable as possible.
I mean, my mind is just so blown. Okay, so you're doing drops on Instagram Mondays at 10 a.m. Things are selling out really quickly. What happened next? Had you done like a copyright? Had you like had,
oh my God,
any
no.
of that happened yet?
No, we had like a janky logo. We changed our Venmo image because this was before Venmo for Business. So we just changed our image to a janky like logo. And then we called it Doe Foods instead of our name. And so, no, we hadn't done it. We hadn't done a trademark. Like, we hadn't done anything. And so it was one of those that like spiraled so fast that we're like, okay, we got to build this plane while we're flying it kind of thing. Uh-huh. Which is honestly, I mean, it's a fun place to be in versus the other way where you produce a bunch of product and then you're like, wait, how do I sell this? So I invested my own money into the business because I was like, I had come from venture capital and I was honestly a little afraid of fundraising because of the ties that come with it and the pressure to grow. And you kind of, there's this conception that isn't entirely wrong that like you grow at all costs and it might not be what's best for profitability or for the business. So I kind of wanted to avoid it at the beginning. So I was like, let me put my money where my mouth is. I'll still keep consulting for a little bit and put money into this business. And then I like distinctly remember the moment in December. It was the holidays and Kristen Cavallari had posted about dough. And that was the moment where I was like, okay, I need to quit everything that I'm doing and like go do this. Like it went bonkers. And I was making the shit. Like I said, I'm not good in the kitchen. I would produce until like 3 a.m. and then fulfill orders at 8 a.m. So it was like this wild cycle of, oh my God, I can't even run the business because I'm making this product all day. And so that's when in January, we were like, we need a co-packer and we need a manufacturer to do this at scale because there's no way in hell we can keep doing this. And, you know, a couple months later is when I was like, okay, we need a fundraise because we had a $100,000 production run. And I was literally like, where am I going to get $100,000 from? And so that's the reason we ended up deciding to fundraise.
Okay, so let's talk about the manufacturing piece of it. So like, what were you looking for? What is the process like? Also, since you, I don't want to call it like specialty, but you know, like it's not standard ingredients necessarily. And you know, it's thoughtfully produced. How do you go about figuring all of that out? Because it's like ingredients, it's packaging, it's equipment. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming like there are different regulations.
There are limited manufacturers in the space. Our first round of a couple of the flavors, we had to end up throwing out the product because it wasn't up to taste standards. And that was one of the hardest. Oh my God, it was like, ooh, this is so much money. And like you hear about it with specifically food, sometimes beverage brands of like, when you scale up a recipe, it doesn't exactly scale. So like you might have your like ratios that you have of oat flour and almond butter and cashews and flaxseed. But when you scale it up, the recipe just changes. And so our product was super dry and not sweet at first.
Weird.
And so you're like, shit, like, do I keep this product? Is it like good enough? It's thousands and thousands of dollars of product. Mm. And that's part of the reason some people fundraise too, right? It's because they want that buffer of like, if you want to just put the best quality product out there, you're going to have to get rid of some of it at the beginning while you work out the kinks.
Yeah.
So that was one of the biggest things we had to learn. And then, I mean, price point, like our product isn't cheap. We charge $15 for a jar of cookie dough, right? And like, because we use oats, almond butter, flaxseed, and then we add vitamins and supplements to the product. It's not a cheap product. And so, you know, figuring out how to manage to make it approachable from a cost perspective with our manufacturer, and then as well being able to kind of source those high quality organic ingredients. They're not just readily available, right? Like there are oftentimes, you know, coconut sugar shortages because usually people use refined sugar. So, you know, it's a good thing my major was supply chain management. it came in handy.
And also, I'd like to point out that this is all going on in a pandemic when there is supply chain issues galore.
Yes. Well, and there still are, which is kind of shocking. Like our like jars are really hard to get. Like their lead time is 6 months. So you have to kind of just like, you know, point your finger in the air and say like, okay, you know, what volume do I think I'm going to be doing in 6 months? Like, you don't actually know, right? Like you project it and you forecast it and you can run all the numbers, but you don't know. You might have a viral TikTok and like, you know, like it just throws off your entire supply chain. So yeah, the ingredients have been harder to get. The transportation has taken longer and everything is more expensive. So I would say the pandemic from a supply chain perspective, it's been a ton of issues on that side, but it has helped from I would say, like, people being comfortable buying food online. Like, yeah. People are more comfortable than ever.
Good silver lining.
Yeah. So there are a lot of the headwinds on the op side, but then the tailwinds on, you know, people are, we're on their phones a lot. So there are some of those tailwinds, which is nice.
So you touched on financing a little bit earlier about raising money. You had obviously, and I believe wisely, been a little reluctant to do that from the jump, but then obviously hit a point when you knew that was a necessity. What was it like?
Yeah, so it's interesting because I've talked to a lot of founders about their fundraising experiences. And obviously coming from M13, I've chatted with founders about it. And usually you hear kind of like negative things about the fundraising experience. And it's, you know, exhausting and it takes too long. It takes several months. And, you know, investors are annoying. And you kind of hear all the bad parts of it. But I surprisingly had a really good experience with it. And I think there's a couple of reasons. So I guess for context, I went out on a Monday and I said, okay, I'm going to raise $500,000. I just need it for the working capital. And by Friday, I had $1 million committed. And I was like, Whoa. Do I take this money? What do I do? And so I ended up taking the money, but I had a lot of mentors that had been through the process who were like, take it now. Like, there are things that go wrong this early. There's reasons you need it. Retail is really expensive. Innovation is really expensive. So, you know, take the money. So I ended up raising $1 million. But the reason I think it was so fast is because we already had proof points from, you know, the 6 months prior where I had put in my own money. The demand was already there. I wasn't fundraising off of just an idea.
Proof of concept.
Yeah, exactly. Like, show me that you have consumers. Who are your consumers? Do you have retailers that are interested? How's the market doing? Like, let me taste the product. And so I think because I had all of those proof points already and I was literally just raising because our demand was outweighing our supply, it was much easier and people were generally more excited to invest.
I also think it had to have helped knowing the other side of it, like knowing what to expect. Like, if you go into this and you've never done it before and you don't know anyone who has, investors could seem annoying. Like, it could feel like a slog, but if you know that that's part of it and on top of that, you're coming in from a different place, like, that's got to help all around.
Yeah. No, and it did help. I mean, I will say it's kind of like kismet, right? That I had VC connections. I had connections to CPG and CPG executives. And then I had a lot of connections to kind of former founders and founders that had exited their own businesses. And so it was kind of like a culmination of like, okay, I have a sweet spot versus like, you know, me coming from, you know, doing some other job and being like, okay, I had this idea and I want to fundraise.
I mean, the Venn diagram overlap of all of these things is tremendous and also really points to like why this would be successful. Like, you have all of the skill sets. It's all in your wheelhouse. You're just using all of these things that you've spent your adult career learning. And it's amazing.
I know. And it's funny, too, because like at the time when you're making the moves throughout your career, like when I went to McKinsey or and I went to Venture, I was so nervous because I'm like, this is something completely new. Like a lot of my peers just stayed in their industries and like climbed the ladder and like are doing super well now from like a cash perspective or from a roles perspective. But you make these pivots and you get really nervous and cold feet. But then when you look back at it, like those were all for a reason for me, right? Like it was to bring me to this point and to be able to launch Dough, you know, versus if I had just stayed on my path to be a CMO at, you know, PepsiCo or Frito-Lay, I don't think I would be internally as satisfied. And I don't think I would be doing what I was meant to be doing. So, you know, what makes you nervous at the time in your career, just it's funny when you look back and you're like, wow, that's why that happened. Or that's why I made that decision, you know?
Yeah, it's really interesting when you look back and see how everything was building towards what you're doing right now.
Yeah.
So it's been about a year, which is crazy because I feel like you've been around forever. Like, I feel like I don't remember a time before your company. But obviously, you're an Erewhon, which for anyone who doesn't know is, I don't want to call it just a health food mecca because they are really known for trend setting, breaking new foods, usually with a very healthy lean for also wellness brands. It's just sort of like where I want to go to shop at all times. It's so amazing. And you're going to do $1 million in sales this year, at least. You have multiple flavors now. You have Drip, which is like a better for you. And also, in my opinion, significantly tastier Nutella.
Oh, thank you.
So how do you think about expansion? How do you think about newness? How do you think about when it's time to add new product in general?
Yeah. So essentially the fundraised money is going towards retail expansion and new product innovation. So by retail expansion, I mean like the Whole Foods of the world. To your point, mm-hmm. Erewhon is essentially where everything, GT's kombucha and like the brands that are really mainstream now, they all started at Erewhon, which is really cool that they're able to kind of like build these brands.
It's like the Barney's of the food world.
Yes.
Back when Barney's New York was alive and thriving and breaking new designers.
Yes, exactly. And a lot of these other health food stores or, you know, natural markets or whatnot, the Whole Foods of the world, they look to Erewhon. And then once it's had success in Erewhon, then you kind of like graduate to like a Whole Foods or a Sprouts, if that makes sense. So
yeah.
Retail expansion is top of mind because at the end of the day, we do have a really big online business, but cookie dough or like this kind of like indulgent, healthy dessert is often an impulse purchase. It's almost like ice cream. Like you go to the store, you get your milk, eggs, like you pick up a few things and like you might grab a pint of ice cream. And so I just want to make sure we are where she is, right? Like we are where our consumer is. So that's one big focus for the next year. And then the next focus is new product line extensions. So we'll obviously double down on cookie dough because the flavors you can do with it are pretty fun. Like we're doing some influencer flavors that have done really well. One of them that's coming up next year is, are you familiar with Alex from the Defined Dish?
Yes, of course.
She's the best. So we're working on something fun with her. And then around like different, you know, holidays, we've got different flavors. So we've got a couple of really fun ones. So we'll keep expanding those. It's pretty, I would say not easy, but it's like the base is the same for all of them. It's like a nut butter, oat flour, you know, flaxseed, coconut sugar. So we've got kind of that similar base. So it's easy for us to play in that space. And then exploring other, you know, snacking categories. So Drip, which is our healthy Nutella, that was our first foray. We've gotten a ton of good feedback on it. So we'll relaunch that. And then I personally think it's interesting how people currently consume our cookie dough. And I think that actually tells us a lot of insight into what we should launch. So we have a lot of consumers that are like, I have a bite of the peanut butter protein before I work out. Or like I, in the mornings, will roll a ball of the chocolate chip because it isn't as sweet and I'll have it with coffee because I don't love eating breakfast, but it's a nice little like bite to eat with breakfast. Or like brownie batter is generally the like red wine and reality TV and brownie batter because it's like an indulgent dessert. So it's just funny to hear and like see on social media because you get so much access to your customers, how people are eating it. And I think that will be the way we figure out what the new products are that we should launch. But I'm super interested in breakfast. So I think there's something there.
Definitely, because I do not like breakfast. So please make it for me. Putting it out there. So you're obviously such a young brand still, but facing such enormous success and love. What is the biggest challenge that you're facing at this exact moment?
So I would say, because I come from bigger brands, Pepsi sold and like Lay's are sold for 99 cents. So you have to be super mindful of your costs. Whereas to grow in a startup, the mindset tends to be like spend, spend, spend. And so I kind of have this like push and pull of like, when do I add on to the team, right? Or like, when do I like make some of our part-time hires full-time hires and bring them on permanently so that we can press the gas? And then how do I balance this growth with being mindful of what's right and what's best for the business? And that's been one of the hardest things to make decisions on. And then as well, this is obviously a little more personal versus the business, but ensuring that I'm transitioning from a player and a team captain to a coach at the right time. And so it's funny that I'm making sports references. I don't watch sports or have anything to do with sports. But like
same.
Right now, I'm fully a player and I'm like the team captain. And like I, you know, have to make sure we're running. And then soon, I think, depending on how we grow, I'll have to transition to more of a coach and like let things go a little bit. And so I think like working on just like personally how and when to do that and developing that trust, right, with the team of like, it's going to be okay. And if everything's not exactly how you want it, like that's fine, right? Like it's, you hire these people because they are good at what they do. So I think like making that transition to coach, I think will be really important and kind of integral for me.
One of the things that we like to talk about on this podcast is mistakes, because we all make them, but we don't always talk about it. And I know I've had a hard time with that historically, but I think that it's so important to do it because so many people learn from it. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you can tell me a mistake that you've made in your career in some form or another and what you've learned from it.
Yeah. I think my obsession with achieving has caused me to just make certain decisions and act a certain way. So it's funny, I had to do this values exercise when I was at McKinsey, and you essentially prioritize your values. And there's 50 values ranging from like family and loyalty to, you know, achievement. And it's, how are you going to prioritize family and friends, right? In a values exercise. My top value, and I was very resentful of this, was achievement. Ooh. And I started crying because I was like, how is this what drives my life, right? Or like my career, is that I'm so obsessed with like the 4.0, or I'm so obsessed with like getting into the best company, or I'm so obsessed with like being the best at something and achieving. And one thing that I thought I needed was I thought I needed to go get my MBA. It's funny because I didn't even end up actually going to business school, but being so kind of short-sighted and that like this is what's going to bring me happiness versus understanding that that's maybe one part of the pie that will bring you happiness. But broadly, I would say prioritizing achievement and specifically, you know, that business school or that MBA process was one where I turned into like not a great person to be around. And I was always like emotional or on edge. And I, you know, wouldn't call my sisters. And like, I was just like in a bad place. And so pulling myself out of that is something I'm still working on, right? That like I do often, and I'm aware that I can get caught up in that. But I would say that's one thing that I'm still working on, but you know, I've come a long way, I would say.
It's a journey. So a lot of the folks who listen to this podcast are in their first life. They want to make a leap or pivot or just do something, whether it's in the same industry or a different industry, but they're scared or nervous or just haven't pulled the trigger yet. So as someone who's made a number of pivots and continues to, I am curious, what advice would you give someone who wants to take that next step but just hasn't quite done it?
It's funny because I would give the same advice for someone who even wants to be an entrepreneur or found a company, and it's just try it. And it doesn't have to be perfect. I think we have this conception of like, the next move I make has to be the perfect salary and the perfect title. And, you know, even with launching a brand, it has to have the perfect brand around it and the most beautiful website designed by the best designers. And it's like, just take the leap. And if it's right, you'll know. And if it's not, you'll move on to the next thing. It's almost like understanding and like talking yourself out of that fear. But I mean, it goes back to what you and I were chatting about earlier of, you don't realize when you're doing it because you're nervous or, you know, like you don't know what's going to come of it. And then you only realize like 5 years later, like, oh yeah, that's why, you know, I did that or that's why it happened to me and that's why I'm here where I am. And, you know, having a backup plan doesn't hurt. Like I was consulting for a reason at the beginning when I started Doe of like, I have rent to pay. So, you know, I've got the cash. And then as well, if this doesn't work out, then I can go back to consulting or go back to corporate life. So having that backup plan, if you're kind of anxious or, you know, risk averse, doesn't hurt at all.
My last question is my favorite question, which is if you could go back in time and give your younger self a little advice, life advice, career advice, any kind of advice, what would you say?
Oh my God. In the words of Kris Jenner, you're doing great, sweetie. I think we just need to hear that. And millennials are funny because they like, they're the first generation that's like, give me feedback, give me feedback. Like, tell me I'm doing great. You know, like it's, and I'm very much so like that. But I think just knowing like you're doing a good job, I think that's all I would have needed to hear. Cause I'm so hard on myself.
Yeah.
And I mean, to your point earlier about having something to prove, especially as, you know, a female in a world full of men, it's hard to give yourself credit and to tell yourself you're doing great. And so almost just being like patient and gentle with yourself and realizing when you have a success and celebrating it versus on to the next thing. So Kris Jenner is my momager.
I mean, the dream, right? Well, thank you so much for your time, Sabina. This has been such a delight. I love your company. I think what you're doing is so phenomenal. I am obviously a big fan and user. Thank you, thank you, thank you. This was such a delight. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That was the founder and CEO of Dough, Sabina Latta. For more inspiring interviews with women like Sabina, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social, and now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you'd like to have on the show, so send your request to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show's at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.